Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Scott Hechinger. He's a longtime public defender, a legal scholar. He's going to tell us why, contrary to a lot of propaganda, cash bail reform has actually been a smashing success. You would never get that reading the press, but that's the truth. Then we'll be joined by Heather Parton, also known as the blogger Digby, to chew the fat about various topics. We're going to talk about the upcoming midterms. Heather is a semi-regular guest and one of my favorites. But first, a couple of related stories in the past week or so should be cause for alarm. They both relate to law enforcement targeting political adversaries with flimsy prosecutions, and in one case with a lot of misinformation. Now, we often say that every accusation levied by Republicans is a confession. Projection is a constant on the right, but I think that obscures a really serious problem we have, which is that, you know, the right's persistent persecution complex may be completely delusional, almost comically so, but it provides them a justification to do what they accuse their opponents of doing. Here we have a kind of a good example, a couple of good examples. You have this widespread belief on the right that the DOJ and the FBI have been weaponized against conservatives for their beliefs. It is, of course, utter nonsense. These are institutions that are known to skew conservative. Republicans have committed a lot of what are prima facie crimes in service of overturning Joe Biden's win. That's the root of it. And of course, Trump, you know, took a bunch of classified documents, which is a no-no. Just as an aside, this is also evident in the small number of actual cases of individual voter fraud, right? They're almost always perpetrated by right-wingers who believe the stupid conspiracy theories that Democrats cheat. And that makes them think that, first of all, it's easy to get away with cheating. And second, that it's justified for them to, like, submit a ballot for their dead grandmother, whatever it is. In their minds, they're just fighting fire with fire. Anyway, in Los Angeles, the county sheriff, Alex Villanueva, who is, he's a real piece of work. He's like, if anyone is a fascist, he's a fascist, right? He oversees a department with literal gangs, right? There are these violent groups of deputies, gangs of deputies. They sport gang tattoos. They have to get jumped into the gang, and they are basically criminals in uniform, right? His department costs LA residents massive amounts of money paying settlements for brutality claims. It's an awful department. His department recently executed these very sketchy search warrants against a couple of people, Sheila Kuehl, who is an LA County supervisor, and Patty Giggins, who is an outspoken member of the Sheriff's Civilian Oversight Commission. These are two of the most vocal critics of this very troubled department, police agency, right? Now, to make a long story short, Villanueva and his investigators say that it isn't politically motivated, of course, right? They say, we're investigating claims that Kuehl funneled $800,000 over a seven-year period, so not a huge amount of money, to a suicide prevention hotline maintained by Giggins' nonprofit. And they say this suicide prevention, they don't deny that the money went to this suicide prevention hotline. They say it was ineffective and that it wasn't put out on bids, right? So it's a public corruption case. Now, if that seems dubious, well, that's not even the whole story. Consider that the Los Angeles Times reported last year that Villanueva had set up this so-called public corruption unit specifically to target his political enemies. Also consider that Villanueva went to a judge who is a close ally of his to get this warrant signed. Now, there's a whole other story about the judge that I don't have time to get into, but let's just say he's enamored with his own power and isn't afraid to use that power for pet projects. There's a whole story here. I don't have time. Also consider that Villanueva's investigators took this investigation, this evidence, whatever, to the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office last September, right? So almost a full year before they made these raids. And they presented their evidence, and the prosecutor's office said, hey, there's no evidence of a crime here. We're not going to prosecute this. So it's Banana Republic stuff. And thankfully, California is not a banana republic. And this case was, just this week, the case was taken away from the sheriff's office by the state attorney general. And a different judge ordered them to stop conducting searches on their political enemies. So that's happening, a disturbing case. Meanwhile, a couple of hours south on the freeway in San Diego, we have this trial of a group of so-called Antifa protesters, and some of them were certainly Antifa, who've been brought up on conspiracy charges, serious charges. They had gotten into a tussle. You know what? Let me just read I'll just quote the Daily Beast here. San Diego County District Attorney Summer Steffen has brought a sweeping new conspiracy case against left-wing protesters who counter-demonstrated at a pro-Trump rally in San Diego. The result was a beachside brawl during which rally-goers on the right flashed a knife and a BB gun, and protesters on the left fired pepper spray. But rather than result in simple assault charges, Steffen is pressing conspiracy charges and only against demonstrators on the left. This is really important. And it turns out that this prosecutor, this wingnut prosecutor, Summer Steffen, has a history of advancing crazy propaganda about Antifa and also peddling anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about, like, George Soros sponsoring Antifa to, I don't know, bring down blah, blah, blah. And as USA Today noted, and I quote, experts say this could be a landmark prosecution that changes how American law enforcement tackles the much misunderstood movement known as Antifa. Steffen's office claims the Antifa side was overwhelmingly responsible for the violence, but experts familiar with the case say it was an extraordinary decision to not charge anyone in the far-right group that actually targeted the community, especially given the videos that exist showing them engaging in violence. So this is a key part of the story. Again, I'm quoting USA Today, which took a pretty deep dive into this case. A USA Today investigation revealed the victims in the DA's case include people identified as white supremacist agitators, notorious for sporting fights in neighborhoods where they're not welcome. At least one has a criminal record and has long been involved with neo-Nazi groups, right? And several others were identified again by local anti-fascist activists as white supremacists who do this, right? It's what they do. And so the DA's office didn't want that to come out, right? And what happened was they used an unusual tool. They sought to have a gag order. They asked the judge, and I think it was granted. They asked the judge to make a gag order which prevented anybody outside the legal team from getting the names or the identities of the victims, the so-called victims in this case, right? And that includes the press and everybody else, right? So it's a absolute cover-up because they don't want to, but so some of the names of these victims did become public because, again, they were extremists known to local Antifa activists. And according to the USA Today, the people named in this case whose identities have been obscured, and I quote, have histories of associating with white supremacist organizations and local racist groups. And they're, you know, they have this history of violence. So here we have a rather clear case of selective prosecution. There are, again, victims of these fascist thugs who traveled to a liberal community to provoke a fight, attacking people unprovoked. And the prosecutor is ignoring them, charging this expansive conspiracy charge, people who just went down to counter-protest and things got, you know, heated. And they're using tools designed to basically protect mob witnesses to obscure the fact that all the so-called victims in her prosecution are violent right-wing extremists. So that's another case. Very similar. And I mean, we can only hope that a jury sees through it. But this is stuff we have to be very vigilant about. The right is convinced that law enforcement is a legitimate tool of politics. They believe that their opponents are weaponizing it, and they are themselves doing just that. It's a dangerous, dangerous path. And on that typically happy note, we're going to move along with the show. Let's take a quick break and then come right back with Scott Hechinger to talk about bail reform. Stay tuned.
There'll be no strings to bind your hands, not if my love can't bind your heart. And there's no need to take a stand, for it was I who chose to start. I see no reason to take me home. I am old enough to face the dawn. Just call me Angel of the Morning, Angel. Just touch my cheek before you leave me. Oh, baby, just call me Angel of the Morning, Angel. Then slowly turn away from me.
Welcome back. You know, I was happy to book our next guest on this week's show because we're going to look at some things that touch on last week's show. And I like the continuity. Last week we had Pat Ryan on, my newly elected member of Congress here in New York's 19th district. And this is a frontline seat. And this past week, I've just been inundated with ads from the RNC. They're going all in trying to flip this seat by painting Ryan as, and I will quote from their ads, dangerously liberal. That's the overarching theme. Then they just plug one kind of talking point, Republican talking point or another, into each ad. So you got the overarching theme, dangerously liberal. Sometimes they focus on wanting to defund the sheriff's office, which is untrue. Other times they accuse him of favoring cash bail reform and letting violent criminals run amok. This is a very popular theme on Fox News and elsewhere in the conservative media. And to be honest, you're also seeing it in the legacy media. And Democrats have done a pretty poor job pushing back on that talking point, even though it's really divorced from reality. Anyway, long preamble. My next guest is trying to do just that, trying to push back on some of this stuff. Scott Hechinger is a veteran public defender, civil rights lawyer. He's the founder of Zealous. It's an advocacy group. You can check out their work at zealous.us. Scott, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thank you for having me on, Joshua.
Thanks for taking the time. So I mentioned that it's not just the conservative media that have run with the idea that cash bail reform has led to a spike in crime. It's a common theme in neutral coverage of crime and public safety. I'm going to ask you about that in a moment. But first, I just want to ask you, because there's so much noise around this issue, I just want to ask you what bail reform actually looks like. Because, I know that the details may vary a little bit by community, but in broad strokes, what is it?
Here's what bail reform is. First of all, let's start at the beginning. What's bail? Bail is an amount of money that you are supposed to pay in order to be released so you can fight your case for revocation of freedom, and the state can be assured that you're going to come back to court. It's like an incentive. If you come back to court, no matter what, at the end of the day, even if you're found guilty, you get the money back. It's an incentive, not a punishment. In reality, bail in this country and in New York serves as punishment because the vast majority of people who have bail set can't afford it. We have 500,000 people around the country who are in jail, incarcerated, presumed innocent, haven't been convicted of anything, solely because they don't have enough money to buy their freedom. That's more people, Joshua, than every single person incarcerated in India pre and post conviction. It's insane. So what bail reform did was it was a modest step in New York. There's very few other jurisdictions that have it, but here's what it looks like in New York. It looked like limiting bail solely for the lowest level offenses. So misdemeanors and some nonviolent felonies, judges can no longer set bail. Violent felonies, the kind of the talking points out there, those still, like before bail reform, remain eligible for bail. And there are, in New York City alone, 6,000 people, nearly 6,000 people incarcerated on still on bail eligible offenses. So that's what it looks like in practice. It allows, just on the law. But what does it look like in practice? What it looks like in practice is it looks like people being able to fight their cases from a position of freedom. It looks like families sticking together, people being able to get medication, staying in homes, staying in jobs. What does it look like in terms of public safety? Barely anyone gets rearrested. And what we've seen is actually that the numbers have held constant from before reform and after reform. It's near non-existent, the number of people who get rearrested for violent felonies. And it's saved New Yorkers hundreds of millions of dollars. And yet, people are calling it a disaster. I think it's one of, if not the most successful public policies that we've ever had as it relates to criminal justice. One that maximizes freedom, fiscal responsibility, and public health and safety.
And I just want to point out for listeners that this was a policy that had widespread bipartisan support at one time. It was supported by law enforcement at one time. There's been a kind of sea change in how we talk about this, not us, but how it is discussed on the right and in the center and much of the center. And there has been, it's one of a number of issue areas where at one point, you saw broad kind of pan-ideological support that has since collapsed. And, you know, we can talk on another show about why that is. But, I mean, it's important to understand, I think, the key takeaway here as far as a lot of the talking points that we hear is that judges are still capable of keeping violent offenders off the street. They're capable of locking them up pending trial. They're capable of keeping people who are at elevated risk of fleeing. They are able to hold them with bail. And various studies have run counter to the idea that holding fewer people in jail pending trial leads to higher levels of crime. We talked about one of them on the show a few weeks back. Of course, there is the very obvious fact that we have seen a spike in mostly gun violence over the last 2 years in places that instituted bail reform and other reforms, and places that did not do so at all. Yep. Right. This is a key point. So correlation doesn't imply causation, but if there is no correlation whatsoever, then there can be no causation. But we've recently gotten what you characterized as, and I quote, robust nonpartisan yes. long-term data from multiple cities that have instituted bail reform. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, and so first I want to just lay this out for folks. Like, folks tend to, and mostly, you know, opponents think of public defenders and folks who also consider themselves abolitionists or folks fighting for bail reform as like, we're just concerned with like getting people out of jail. And like, the answer is yes, because it's actually what data shows is going to lead us to public health and safety. I'm a dad. Half my family lives in New York City. I care deeply about public health and safety. This is why I'm so outraged. And crime is, I mean, we can talk about statistics that show that, and it's true, that crime levels, even violent crime levels today compared to 20 years ago in the 2000s, let alone in the 90s and 80s, is far lower. But it doesn't matter because one person harmed, let alone 100 or 1,000, whatever it is one too many. If violence is real, crime is real, which is why we need to follow data and statistics. And I've been in the position for before bail reform, basically being like, trust me, I know as a public defender that people return to court. I know as a public defender over thousands of cases that the vast majority don't go on to get rearrested for anything, let alone violent felonies. But it was more of a, you got to look at the reason here. Like, clearly what we're doing is not working. But now, Joshua, not just in New York, but in Houston, Texas, in Los Angeles, these other places that have instituted real bail reform years out, so we're not even looking at short run statistics, it's unanimous. Right. It's unanimous. In New York, hundreds of thousands of people free, hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer dollars saved, in zero correlation to any violent crime increase. And in fact, the opposite. That exact same number is what we're seeing out of the most robust study out of the Quattron Center in Harris County. That includes Houston, Texas. And for 18 months in Los Angeles, they had an emergency bail schedule. So this is following COVID. The judges instituted a decarceration policy for health reasons. And what do they find? The same deal. Actually, lower rates of rearrest from before the emergency bail schedule. But here's the problem. They just ended that 2 months ago, and I guarantee you not an infinitesimally small number of people in LA even knew they had bail reform, let alone the fact that it was as successful as it was. Because if they did and they really understood it, you know, they wouldn't have been able to just quietly get rid of it. But what it comes down to is that you know, I'm looking at data statistics. I know the people who are being released, but all it takes is that like that one sensational case that might not have anything to do with bail reform whatsoever to institute and to instill that fear and that anger and that kind of terror in people who are already predisposed to thinking about incarceration as the only solution from popular culture. Police is the only response to crime, or the fact that somehow, despite reason, throwing someone in horrific conditions characterized by isolation, shame, economic deprivation, and violence is somehow going to make a person less likely to reoffend. We know this. We know that doesn't make sense. And yet people are still driven by that fear and don't base their decisions on reason. And it's a pretty like scary moment right now, because we have this opportunity. We have this amazing law. We have a win. And why aren't we celebrating it? And this goes to Democrats versus Republicans. Democrats aren't doing, it isn't just that Democrats are doing a bad job at pushing back. It's that they should be affirmatively standing behind this policy, not just defending it. They should be praising it. They should be talking about the stories. They should be talking about this in a way that appeals to everyone. They're not going to win on law and order. So they should lean in on the truth and lean in and not let police, prosecutors, and the GOP continue to kind of own the conversation around public safety. Because look, if what we were doing right now made us the healthy and safe, we should be the healthiest and safest state and society in the history of the world, because we spend more money than we ever than in any other society in the history of the world on incarceration, prosecutions, police, etc. And we're not, it turns out. By NYPD's and police's own, you know, admission. Every time they go off and they talk about crime is out of control, it's a pandemic of violence. Why are we not asking them? Anyway, isn't that an admission of the failure of billions of dollars investment into your strategy and policy that we've been paying you for, you know, a half a century? Shouldn't we not be continuing to invest in failure? Maybe we should try something different that actually has data to back it up. You know, it makes no sense.
This is a point that I come to back to very often on this show. We not only spend more on policing than any other country, we spend more on policing than many countries spend on national defense, on their military. And it is really, when you step back, it's stunning that this is a policing specifically is a profession where they brag about their failures. You know, that is something that they go and they hold press conferences and they say, well, we're the police and crime is out of control. And also, by the way, we don't even acknowledge that it's part of our job to defend, to protect people's civil liberties, right? The policing, they have a dual mandate, or they should have a dual mandate. In theory, they have a dual mandate. right? Which is to prevent crime and to prosecute people who commit crime while upholding civil liberties. This is a part that they often forget as part of their job. But let me step back a little bit. The data actually show that reducing the number of people who we lock up while they await trial reduces recidivism. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Why do we know what the mechanisms are for that, Scott? Like, why would that be?
So it turns out, you know, I mentioned some of these characteristics of over-policing and prosecutions and jails and prisons, but think about the primary characteristics of jail, pretrial detention in the United States right now, are the exact same drivers of violence itself. And that's isolation, shame, economic deprivation, and violence. And so we wind up investing an extraordinary amount of money in putting people in situations that only exacerbate the underlying issues that they were already dealing with and making it more likely for them to not just get rearrested, but get rearrested for violent offenses. When they are released, and by the way, there's so many options under bail reform. It's not just released on their own recognizance. There's also additional funding for supervised release and support services. In addition to the support services, they're with their families. They keep their jobs, they're able to pay their bills, they're able to keep their housing, they're able to take their medication, they're able to remain stable and happier. And their cases also resolve much more favorably. And so at the end of the day, you come out after a case is done and with the high likelihood, great likelihood, and I'm talking even in cases involving violence, I just want to stress again, violent felonies are subject to bail, and most and judges have wide discretion to set bail, and they do set bail. When folks get out or get out and pay bail or they're released on violent offenses, those cases, like every other cases, they often end 70% of violent felonies end in dismissals. Like most of them end in dismissals. So at the end of the day, you have someone who's less likely to have a criminal record, so they're less likely to get further marginalized. They're more stable and keep their jobs, so they're able to pay their bills and be less desperate. And they avoid being in a situation, even heightened during COVID, where that is literally deadly and is what a lot of people now call criminogenic. Like carcinogenic, it makes you more likely to actually get rearrested or be put in a situation to be targeted for arrest. That's why. And that's why we see it. And it isn't just the past 3 years. This is bail reform in New York and bail reform elsewhere. It's really tracked and just kind of continued a long time of steady decarceration. Since the early 2000s, there was something like, God, I should have the numbers at the ready, but it was, I'll just say safely, because I think it was actually over 80%. Over 70% reduction in the number of people caged in New York City jails. And in that same amount of time, major violent crimes went down by around the same percent, over 70%. So you see a long-term trend that decarceration actually parallels a reduction in crime overall, let alone recidivism. That's really compelling, not feelings, but facts. And we should be leaning into that, not leaning away from it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's so maddening about the fact that Democrats and liberals have failed to articulate a kind of coherent counter to the idea that you just flood the zone with more cops and put more people in jail, failed to articulate a different approach to public safety, is that they really should be able to do so, given the facts, mm-hmm. right? I mean, even in the last 2 years, we've seen mostly, again, a spike in gun violence. That's been the big driver. And you've seen other types of crimes decrease in 2020 and 2021. And, you know, this correlated with a significant increase in gun ownership, including a significant increase in new gun owners, people who have started carrying guns or owning guns for the first time. That occurred during the same period. Also, as you just said, it's liberals and progressives who have an idea of how to address the root causes of crime. You know, most of the spike in gun violence in the last couple of years occurred in marginalized communities and economically marginalized communities and communities without enough supports. And finally, there is, as we've made pretty clear on this show and in past shows, we've talked about this in the past, there is very little evidence that putting more cops on the streets or locking more people up has any beneficial effect, and quite a bit suggesting that the opposite is true. I mentioned the legacy media, and you recently highlighted what is kind of a case study in how they amplify tough on crime talking points that aren't supported by the facts. Scott, can you talk a little bit about what went down in Nassau County, New York recently when conservative politicians commissioned a study and they set out to look for evidence of a link between bail reform and crime?
So this is, it would be funny if it weren't so dangerous and if the media didn't take the bait so much. So you've got a GOP county executive in Nassau County, New York. And for those who don't know Nassau County, that's a big chunk of Long Island. I was in Brooklyn for 20 years. I grew up in DC and I still couldn't really get myself to get there. But anyway,
it's like the French. It's a liaison.
Long Island. I'll keep working on it. So okay, this GOP county executive who is, you know, interested in politicizing and weaponizing tragedy and crime to win, he commissions this study. And it's a total, you know, slap. It's just a ridiculous self-own, because the study comes back, not surprisingly, because it's consistent with everything else we're seeing, that not only was there no correlation in the increases that they were seeing in crime that were consistent everywhere in the country in red and blue states and the vast majority of places that have no bail reform. But in fact, they showed that rearrest rates plummeted since before bail reform. And it also, this report came out around the same time that Nassau County, this county that he is painting as not only a pandemic of crime, but because of bail reform, was named the safest county in the country by US News and World Reports for the second year running since bail reform started. So you have here this immaculate cell phone by this GOP politician, and the data is right there. He based it off of Nassau County's based on police data. Slam dunk, right? And this is like the clearest example. And yet this is what they do. You can imagine this GOP executive sitting down and being like, well, this is not good for us, but we obviously are not going to stop lying. So what do we do? What we're going to do is we're just going to scare the hell out of people. We're going to still say that there's a correlation, and it's a straight up lie when there's not. We're not going to talk about the lack of rearrest. We're just going to talk about the sheer number of people who are released. And so they come out with this press release and then press conference. And this is weeks ago. And they just today did another full court press talking about the facts that out of everyone arrested in Nassau County in X period, 87% were released. And crime is terrible and it's a pandemic. And so you're just like, oh my God, that sounds like an extraordinary number of people released. Like, of course there's a correlation. The media ran with this. Fox News ran with it. New York Post, CBS. And they did that again today, even after it was pointed out that they didn't ask the follow-up question. Of those 87% of people who were released, what wound up happening in those cases? And what wound up happening in those cases is a statistically insignificant number of people were rearrested for violent felenies out of those 87%. Only 7% were rearrested for anything during that entire period. And taxpayers saved an enormous amount of money. And so it actually showed that the vast, 87% of the time, people avoided unnecessary, immensely costly pretrial detention. Wait a second.
It's not 87% of the time. So those people, not all of them would have been held in any event, right?
Well, prior to bail reform. So what you can say is the 87% of people who were released, I think you're right. Let's put it this way. 87% of the people who were released were not incarcerated. of those who are no longer eligible for bail, so misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies, they avoided even the prospect of bail being set. When judges have discretion to set bail, there's always a chance it's going to happen. It could be just jumping the turnstile. And as a public defender, I can tell you, you get in front of the right judge, even in progressive, I'm using air quotes, Brooklyn, bail might be set depending on the person's record. Might be the lowest level, might be a heroin stem or just like residue, you know, and someone's clearly struggling with substance use. That could be someone that has bail set. Bottom line is the folks who are not going in because judges don't have discretion, those are people who avoided the possibility of going in. So sorry, and thank you for the clarification. But I think it's important to note that, like, when you give judges discretion, because that's what the other side wants to have happen, they want carte blanche discretion, not only to allow people to be incarcerated for anything pretrial, but also for the judges to consider this very, you know, scary sounding word, dangerousness, in assessing whether someone should be incarcerated. And what we know from experience is that the more, again, you give judges any discretion, they're going to use it for cruelty. And if you give them even more discretion to basically try to crystal ball gaze and determine whether they think that this person could go on to you know, get rearrested or hurt someone, even when that's not the case, so many more people are going to get wrapped up and thrown in pretrial cages.
You know, we're about out of time, but I would feel remiss if we didn't mention that prior to bail reform, what would happen is that implicit racial bias was often a very clear factor, a demonstrable factor in judges deciding who would and wouldn't be held and what bail people would get. Bail was very frequently used to lock up people who were poor. A lot of people, and people who were poor, people of color, a lot of people have been locked up with bail that were very, very low amounts. People who could not come up with $500 to get out of prison. And there was a great study done a couple of years ago by the Brennan Center of Justice on this. Listeners who want to get into the details there can just Google that, Brennan Center for Justice bail reform. And the evidence was fairly clear. And again, this is why at one point there was such broad support for bail reform before it collapsed. Scott, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really do appreciate it.
Appreciate you and keep raising up this issue. People need to become, you know, just more informed, but also, more skeptical consumers of news. You all know now, you've seen the iPhone footage, police lie all of the time. So why are we choosing to believe them when it comes to policies that, if they succeed, will benefit them and continue to line their pockets with billions and billions more dollars in taxpayer investment? So just be more skeptical consumers of news. And if you care about public health and safety, listen to public defenders, listen to non-police sources. We care about public health and safety and fiscal responsibility. And thanks for listening.
Folks, follow Scott Hechinger on Twitter. Check his work at zealous.us. Stay tuned. We'll take a break and come right back.
Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day, will I run to the rock? Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord, all on that day. But the rock cried out, I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I ain't gonna hide you, God. All on that day, I said, Rock, what's the matter with you, Rock? Don't you see I need you, Rock? Lord, 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 all on that day. So I ran to the river. It was bleeding around to the sea.
Welcome back. We are joined now by Heather Digby Parton. Heather is a columnist with Salon. She also writes at her own joint, Hullabaloo. She is, of course, a favorite of the show. Welcome back, Heather.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. There's a lot going on right now, as usual these days. You know, we never seem to get much of a lull, do we?
No, never. I'm never searching for something to write about or talk about. It's always something.
Being in America is exhausting right now. You know, I went away. I went away for a trip, and I went diving. You know, as I tend to do.
Ooh, lucky you.
And I went out of the country, and I was like, oh my God, it was such a nice break. Like, I didn't see any giant trucks with like Let's Go Brandon bullshit. I wasn't worried about anybody opening fire. Like, it was just
to be out of the country. Oh God, yeah. Being an American is not easy at the moment.
Stressful.
Yeah,
stressful.
Really is.
And you wonder why our life expectancy is dropping below industrial country, right? I mean, stress is a killer.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And we are stressed and have been for quite some time. I mean, I don't know how far you want to go back to it, but I mean, I'd say to at least since 9/11.
Yeah, at least crazy. Since 9/11. Yeah. All right. I'd probably go back just a tad further to the 2000 decision.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That.
But I mean, it's amped up since 2016, I think, because, you know. Oh, yeah. Everybody likes to say, and it's true, that Trump did not make Republicans into bigots. He did not, right? But he changed the permission structure. And he told these people that, like, look, a politician can come down a escalator and rail about Mexicans being rapists and blah, 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 and be elected president. And, you know, that's not a fringe proposition. So you can let your... You know, let your feelings out as well. And it's it changed the permission structure.
That's a great way of putting it. That's absolutely what it was. This stuff was percolating, of course, forever. And, yeah. You know, that he didn't invent, you know, bigotry or just, you know, being a jackass. I mean, that's obviously part of the human condition. But what you're absolutely right. What he did do was give permission to people to express that in this crude, aggressive, and hostile way, in a way that really it hadn't been. I mean, to me, the moment that I realized that wasn't when he said Mexicans are rapists, although that was shocking. But it was when he said that John, you know, he didn't admire John McCain. He liked, you know, he liked war heroes who didn't get captured. And to me, you know, I mean, that's, you know, we've heard stuff like that, you know, on the left, there's been criticisms of McCain and everything for years. But I had never believed that, you know, the sort of patriotic flag waving, you know, love it or leave it right would ever put up with that. And when they did, I went, oh, we're in a whole different space now. You know, this is like, you can say anything. You can say anything. And if they like you, that's fine. You can get away with it. There are no limits. And Trump has proved since then that there are no limits.
And the other thing that's related is that, like, you know, the grievance industry predated Trump, certainly, but his brand of constant caterwauling about being persecuted, right? That justifies violence against your enemies. That justifies, you know, any means necessary. And we see it with these crazy stunts that Greg Abbott and DeSantis are pulling off, and just... There's no bottom. There are no limits now, and it's a frightening time, because it seems like, you know, a lot of people are afraid to say that clearly when it is clearly the case. Here we are 7 weeks out from the midterms. There was a new Siena College poll that came out, I think today. We're recording this on Thursday. It found that those who are strongly opposed to the Supreme Court overturning Roe outnumber those who are just somewhat opposed to the decision, those who somewhat support the decision, and those who strongly support it combined, right? So they're like 52% strongly oppose this Roe court killing the Roe compromise that governed for like 50 years, right? But Lindsey Graham is on TV shouting that while he insisted that abortion was a state issue a few months back, now it's not a state's rights issue. He is sponsoring a nationwide ban on abortion at 15 weeks, which even many of his Republican colleagues are like, what are you doing, Lindsey? This is not a good idea. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy accidentally unveiled a new contract on America on the RNC's website. He then, like, it was, they weren't supposed to make it public. They password protected it real quick, but some reporters saw it, called for a nationwide ban, possibly at conception. Politico reports that Republicans are also calling for, across the country, cuts to Social Security and Medicare, privatizing those programs. This was long characterized as the third rail of politics. And all of this seems like, on its face, political malpractice. But, I mean, it's confusing because you'd think they'd be capable of just reading the polls. Heather, do you think this is a reflection of just how, I don't know, deeply ensconced they are in the conservative media bubble, or does it, is it a reflection of the growth and influence by, like, you know, Peter Thiel and these giant donors? Or what do you make of this? It just seems so counterintuitive.
It does. And, you know, it's, part of me just thinks maybe it's just, you know, it's Republicans in disarray, you know, that it does happen. The party is confused about itself. It doesn't really know what to do particularly in light of the Roe decision, which seems to have caught them completely flat-footed, and they were unprepared for the backlash that was going to happen. I mean, in fact, that, you know, those numbers that you just said about this from the Siena poll are really interesting, because for years, the numbers have been pretty static about, you know, pro various iterations of what meant, you know, support for Roe or, you know, the pro-life definition, however. And it's changed dramatically to people yeah. are more in favor of Roe versus Wade and the right to abortion than they were before. And that is new. That was had been the same for like 25 or 30 years. I mean, it hadn't changed. So they didn't know. They did not. They were unprepared for this kind of reaction. I think they thought people would go, oh, well, you know, it's status quo and, you know, well, we'll find it out in the States or whatever. So I think in that case, that they didn't really know what to do. Now, the McCarthy thing, I am completely flummoxed by that. What advantage they think they'll have with a bunch of issue things that even Donald Trump wasn't for cutting Social Security. I mean, he promised to protect it. I mean, you know, the idea that they would go back to sort of a cramped Newt Gingrich style, you know, assault on big government or whatever, that just seems completely out of time. The culture war is where it's at, right? I mean, that's what the Republicans are ginning up their base with. I mean, if you go and listen to Donald Trump or really any of them, DeSantis, I mean, the stuff he's doing with immigration, that's all culture war stuff. Yes. This idea of going after Social Security or in the midst of all of this, saying that you're going to institute a complete ban. I mean, I think the idea is that they want to generate, you know, Graham thought that he was generating a moderate way on abortion that somehow or another would please people without thinking would please the sort of people who are uncomfortable with please Republicans who were uncomfortable with the Dobbs decision. And instead it ended up, you know, he's going to ban it in California. I mean, that is not the way, that's not what Republican suburban women, even in Texas, are thinking needs to happen here. I mean, that is just not the way that is not where the country is on this. And McCarthy seems to be thinking that somehow or another, he can gin up his base by kind of reviving a Tea Party-like thing, which has been, you know, that whole thing has been gone for some time. I mean, granted, a lot of the same people were involved with the Tea Party that are in the MAGA cult, but they've moved on. You know, these are not the issues that they care about. So I'm unclear, Joshua, to tell you the truth. My instinct is to just say, you know, they're kind of grasping for some kind of traction here going into this election to gin up their base, to ensure that they get a big turnout. And, you know, you would expect that they'd have a big turnout because it's the, you know, the usual off-year election referendum on the party in power. But they seem to be nervous about this. I mean, you look at Marco Rubio down there in Florida. Now, he should be a shoo-in, right? I mean, Florida's pretty much a red state now. He was genuinely, I think, well liked by, you know, a majority down there. And DeSantis, you know, seems to be popular, God knows why. But he has gone full MAGA. I mean, to the point where, I mean, he co-sponsored that Lindsey Graham thing, the abortion thing. I mean, why is he going so far? You know, why is it so important for him to be as extreme as he can possibly get away with? I have to assume that they're worried. Why else would they do that? They're worried about getting their own people out, because otherwise you'd be, you know, the logic is that you play to your, you know, your base in the primary, and then you move to the center during the general election in these statewide races. And he's not. I mean, that's not to say he's going to lose. But why else would he be doing this? I mean, he's not going to appeal to anyone but a hardcore Republican who is completely on the Trump train with the way that he's campaigning. So, you know, that's the only thing I can come up with. I can't think of any other good reason why they would be doing this.
I mean, you know, it's obviously the case that they have done everything that they can to insulate themselves from democratic accountability. So they're giving up on majoritarian politics to a degree, but that seems reckless from their perspective, because, you know, it is still the case that if you go out to the polls and you swamp them with votes, you're going to win. You know, Democrats have a well-funded legal team, and the courts are still more or less functional, you know. But I related to this, you recently wrote at Salon about the pernicious impacts of the right's conspiracy theories about the 2020 election and election fraud more generally. It obviously didn't start in 2020. You note that 60% of the population will have an election denier on their ballot. Like I just said, Trump was the most ham-fisted and ridiculous kind of purveyor of the so-called big lie, but it's been used to justify voter suppression for a couple of decades, beginning when they realized that their base was shrinking and that majoritarian rule would become a problem for them. One thing I think is different post-Trump is that right-wingers have taken to accusing the Republican Party of fraud when they lose primary contest. This is different than it used to be. Right. It used to be, oh, Democrats, or there's dead Democrats are voting in Chicago, whatever. Now they're like, I lost my primary by a huge margin because I'm a wackadoodle, and maybe because I've got a criminal case pending in the case of Tina, the election, former election clerk in Colorado. You know, Tina Peters.
Yeah.
You know, she's got a criminal case pending. She said, oh, it's fraud, when she lost her primary. And much like telegraphing that they are coming for Social Security and Medicare, or banning abortion in blue states if they have the power, this kind of infighting, I mean, should presumably hurt the party in November. And yet, you know, here we go. I think this must be what you're talking about. It's just Republicans in disarray.
Well, I mean, how else to explain that? I mean, that's got to be the goofiest thing I've heard. And it didn't just happen, you know, one or two times. I mean, a bunch of these Republicans, and of course, you're absolutely, they are the wackadoos, the, you know, the far right MAGA. There was a guy up in Michigan. He came in fourth, and I think he was running for the gubernatorial nomination up there in the Republican Party, and he was a January 6th.
He got like 11%.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, he was blown out, and yet, of course, he comes out and completely starts complaining about election fraud. I mean, it's like, I mean, when I wrote that piece, I was thinking, you know, will they ever concede anything? I mean, is it even possible that they're going to concede? I mean, they're putting this idea out there. To it, you know, and to the wackadoodle candidates, and of course the wackadoodle voters, that it's impossible for them to lose. Right? I can't lose. I, you know, this is ridiculous. Of course I will win, because I am, I don't know, on the side of right or God or somehow or another. You know, everything's, all the polls are wrong, and the media's unfair, and you know, I'm winning because everyone agrees with me. And there's always been that element, on the right, they always had this idea somehow that everyone agreed with them. It was just a few weirdos on the coast who disagreed, but the whole country was really on their side, and that, you know, and of course, you know, they're wrong, but in fact, they're really wrong, that because the popular vote in the presidential race has shown otherwise. If we lived in a fair democracy, it would be clear that they are in a minority. But, you know, this idea that they can't possibly lose, I mean, that's Donald Trump, right? That is him. He is a guy who will never admit that he lost. It's driving him absolutely mad that he lost that election to the extent that he's willing to take down the whole country to, yes, you know, to prove otherwise, or to pretend to prove otherwise. He just cannot admit it, that it's impossible for him. And so now he, you know, there are a bunch of Republicans out there, tens of millions of them, by the way, because there's a poll in the New York Times today, Thursday, showing that none of the stuff that's happened in the last few months, from the January 6th committee to the, you know, the stealing of documents and storing them in Mar-a-Lago, and the FBI, you know, having to go down there and search his property to get them back, none of that has shaken his base. They still approve of him. And it's a lot of people. It's something like 43-44% of the country that don't, you know, that hasn't changed their minds about him, according to this latest poll. And I, you know, I just find that stunning, that, yeah, that nothing seems to, and this was true, you remember, throughout his entire presidency, it was just this same number of people, they were asked, and that would just, nothing would shake it, no matter what he did, no matter what was happening. Like Biden's doing like a normal kind of approval rating. He started off pretty high and then he sunk, went way low. Now he's kind of crawling back up again. That's pretty normal. Yeah. You know, if you look at the past few presidencies, you know, even George W. Bush, who had a huge spike after 9/11 in approval, he went down and went up and went down. You know, I mean, it's just not Trump. It was just a solid straight line of people who they will not be shaken from their approval of him. And I just don't know what to say about these people, but there are tens of millions of them. And yeah, that's kind of creepy.
There are. Now, I think it's important to caveat that, because the way that the New York Times characterized that poll is that, like, it hasn't hurt Trump's popularity, right? And the thing that this was a Siena College poll. And the thing that I would note is that while that's true on its face, he is not popular. He's extremely unpopular. And one difference between public opinion of Trump and public opinion of other presidents is that some polls ask, do you strongly approve, mm-hmm, do you strongly favor, do you strongly or somewhat approve, right? And his strongly disapprove, strongly unfavorable numbers are always off the charts. So like with Biden, there's a lot of, you know, Dem leaning independents who say, yeah, I don't really approve of the job he's doing, but you know, it's somewhat disapprove. And that's, of course, has a lot to do with Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema and stuff.
Sure.
But there's a lot of soft disapproval of Biden, which is why his numbers have increased. His numbers have been coming back up because Democrats,
right,
have been saying, oh yeah, you know what, I'm actually approving of this guy. So that's one point. The other point that I would make is that, like, you know, you're right that these people have been told since Nixon, right, that they belong to a silent majority, that, you know, even whatever the polls say, whatever, you know, Donald Trump, the idea that Donald Trump won the election is absolutely ludicrous when you think of the fact that his favorability went underwater on his 11th day in the presidency and stayed there the whole time. And his, you know, again, the intensity of people's dislike for him was off the charts. But all those people, you know, first of all, we live in we are geographically sorted to the point where you can only meet other MAGA people. you know, in your daily life, if you're, you know, wherever in West Virginia or wherever, when you go out and you talk to other people, yeah, everybody hates Democrats, right? Everybody loves Trump. So, you know, I mean, one example of this is a small thing, but like the U.S. Park Service estimated that on January 6th, there was 30,000 people who came out for Trump's speech. And then the Capitol Police estimated that maybe 10,000 went on to the riot at Capitol Hill, right? Every Republican in the world believes that there was 1 million people there.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like a matter of faith. Mm-hmm. And that's like, it's all related. It is really like, here we have this intensely anti-majoritarian party. On some level, they know that they're not the majority. But they don't think that the groups that make up the majority are legitimate.
Right.
Or should have a say in how we, you know, how we conduct affairs. And then they're also told, you're part of a silent majority. So it's like, it's internally contradictory, but they hold both of those views simultaneously.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's kind of a new iteration of this that I find fascinating. And it's this idea that there's this shy Trump voter. You know, there's been all this discussion of the polling recently about whether or not the polls are going to miss, if the polls are missing Republicans in the polling right now, as they did in 2020 and in 2016. And yeah. Nate Cohn of New York Times brought this up and said,
he's obsessed.
And he brings this up and it causes a big, you know, everybody's talking about it and what have you. Are they missing Republicans again? Are they doing it again? And oh, it's terrible. And it stems from this idea that there's something called the shy Trump voter. And one of the guys, and I can't remember his name now, who's with Trafalgar, which is a Republican-leaning polling firm. And he did a series of tweets about it, talking about this shy Trump voter phenomenon. And he said, you know, in which he gave it away that he's not, you know, that they're not legit. He goes, they won't even talk to us, you know, like even us, even right wing, you know, yeah. biased pollsters and like us, they won't even talk to. Yeah, exactly. But it was very interesting to me, his excuse. And the excuse is that it's because, and I'm sure you've talked about this as well, this idea that it was because Hillary Clinton called Trump voters are called a portion of Trump voters deplorable. And now Biden has called out the, you know, the MAGA Republicans as, you know, said they're semi-fascist, that it's caused. And I think here's the interesting part. It's not he's acknowledging that it makes no sense that MAGA Republicans, Trump voters, are shrinking violets who are afraid to tell anybody what they think. Pretty clearly, those people are not shrinking violets.
They're obnoxious.
They're the people who are out there saying, fuck your feelings, right? Yeah. I mean, this is those kind of people. But his theory is that there are a whole bunch of other Republicans who really like Trump. They're not like that, but they really like him. And they might not have voted for him, but when Biden and Clinton called, you know, them, called Republican voters deplorable or semi-fascist, that they, out of apparent solidarity with the loud, obnoxious MAGAs, have then decided to vote for Trump, but they're not going to tell anybody
because they don't want to put them.
Yeah, you know, it's so insulting to their own voters in a lot of ways. You know, it's like saying, "What? Give me a break, really? Yeah. You people that you know." So the other side said,
space.
"Yeah, really? Can we give you, you know,
trigger
you?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, you know." But
let me tell you something. This is data generals fighting the last war. Because,
yeah.
I mean, first of all, Nate Cohn. He cited 2020 and 2016 polling. This is a midterm poll. This is a midterm election. Should be a dissimilar electorate.
Yeah.
But the thing, my theory of the case is that you have a lot of irregular Democratic voters who are not going to get it past the likely voter screens that pollsters put up to screen out their samples, right? Pollsters say, have you voted last time? How often do you? And then they say, oh, this person is not likely to vote. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're not even responding to polls and they're irregular voters and they're pissed off. And I think we're underestimating Democratic turnout. And that is why, I mean, you should always ignore the polls and work hard like you're 3 points down, but more so this year than any other. And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised. I think a lot of Democrats are fired up, and I don't think it's going to look like the typical low turnout affair where, you know, Republican voters being older and blah, 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 more reliable voters are going to show up and the Democrats are going to be complacent. I don't see that happening at all. So take it all with a grain of salt. Heather, I believe we are out of time. Oh, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Thanks so much. I'd also like to thank Scott Heckinger and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
Oh, little love survive. I draw the tears from your eyes. Just don't let a good thing die. When, honey, you know I've never lied to you. Caught in a trap, I can't walk out, because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me? When you don't believe a word I say, we can go on together with suspicious minds, and we can't build our dreams on suspicious minds.